haired weirdos, short haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My guest today is media expert Matthew Pressman, an assistant professor of journalism at Seton Hall University. Prior to earning his doctorate in history, he worked for 8 years at Vanity Fair, where his articles about the news media won the 2010 Mirror Award for Best Commentary, Digital Media. He's the author of On Press, The Liberal Values That Shape the News, which we'll be talking about today. Matthew Pressman, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, it was interesting how you chose to examine the media and the changes in the media over the last, well, really kind of half century or so. You focused on two specific papers, the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. And so I was curious, why did you decide on that approach and specifically those two papers?
Well, I wanted to try to examine how the values that shape the contemporary news media emerged in the 1960s and 70s. So I wanted to look at news outlets that really influenced the whole industry. So I wanted to look at big, prominent newspapers because I'm trying to examine the values of the dominant mainstream press mainly. So the New York Times certainly still does, and for a long time has kind of set the tone for the rest of the industry. It's been very looked up to and respected within the industry. And the LA Times I thought would offer a nice geographic contrast and also an interesting political contrast, because some people don't realize that prior to the 1960s, the LA Times was really quite a conservative newspaper. So that was one reason. And then I also had a kind of practical reason, which is that my training is as a historian, and I do historical research, and those two newspapers, it so happens, have wonderfully well-preserved archives at the New York Public Library for the time for the New York Times and at the Huntington Library in California for the LA Times. So I was able to look at the personal papers, company records of all of the or many of the editors and publishers who worked there, which really gives a wonderful inside perspective.
Yeah. But, and what I really liked about focusing, I mean, you don't focus exclusively, you mentioned some other media at times, but it seems to me it just made the story much more, well, focused, and it made it easier for me to sort of get into the story. And so I really like that approach.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I think so too. It just helps to have some specific kind of case study to look at. And these two are really fascinating ones, I think. And there was so much turmoil also going on at these two newspapers during that period, both inside the newsroom and between the newspapers and the outside world and the people they covered, their audience.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, most of the book focuses on this period roughly from 1960 to 1980, which for a lot of reasons was a pretty unusual time. And it seems to me that one thing that stood out is maybe the most important reason is that during this period, we see this shift from what's sometimes called straight news reporting or objective reporting to much more analysis and interpretation. And so that word objectivity, that's an interesting word. And I thought maybe a good place to start would be to talk a little bit about what that word means, or at least what it meant to, you know, editors and publishers in the 50s and the 60s, you know, before this period started, and why they thought it was such an important value.
Right. Well. Sure. I mean, we could probably spend the whole interview talking about the history of objectivity and debates over it and what it means to people. But certainly that's at the heart of many of the questions that I try to address in the book. And yes, you point out the sort of shift to more analytical and interpretive reporting starting around the 1950s, and that's what I talk about in the book's first chapter, because I think it kind of sets the table for all the conflicts and challenges that I address in the remainder of the book. And I think the important change is that prior to that period, really objectivity only became a major value for most of the news media around the 1920s or so. But for that period and through the period of the Depression and World War II and the kind of early Cold War years, it meant basically this notion of just the facts, right? And one, I think, useful way to look at it is that when reporters today are taught about what they should include in their stories, breaking news stories, it's the five W's and H. So the five W's and H, who, what, where, when, why, and how. But prior to the growth of interpretive reporting, the why question wasn't really part of it. There were only four W's, just who, what, where, and when. So I think that's the key change that comes about. And for a lot of newspaper editors and executives, they thought that it was incompatible with objectivity. Some did, and that's why they resisted it for a long time. But eventually, I argue, at least by the 1960s, most of the people inside the news industry had changed their definition of objectivity a little bit to allow for some of the reporters' judgments, not personal opinions and personal feelings and biases, hopefully, but kind of professional judgments based on their expertise and the reporting that they had done. But that becomes contentious, you know, as I discuss in the book.
Yeah, definitely. And it seems like there were a lot of reasons why we saw this shift. I mean, the ones that really kind of came out in my reading of the book was, first off, kind of preventing future Joe McCarthy's. There was a threat from TV and magazines. The world was growing more and more complex, and people were becoming much more educated, including a lot of people in the news business. And so I was hoping you could maybe talk a little bit about these things and how they sort of moved along that shift.
Yeah, right. So I think all four of those are important factors in this change in the growth of interpretive reporting. In my view, the most important probably is that competitive threat, the economic threat, and I argue in the book that really drives most of the changes more than anything else that occur in this period. The desire of newspapers to stay competitive and to reverse troubling trends in circulation and newspaper readership. So certainly with the growth of TV news, well, that's going to provide the breaking news headlines that people want to know, and that's free, and it's easier to watch than it is to read a newspaper. So there was the sense that newspapers needed to provide something different. If they wanted to give people a compelling reason to continue subscribing or buying the paper, they had to provide more than that those viewers were getting from TV news and more than they were getting from magazines. So I think that was really the driving factor, and it comes through in many of the memos and the correspondence that I found from the reporters and editors and publishers from this period. But I do think another really important factor is, as you mentioned, Senator Joseph McCarthy, because really the industry had been kind of calling for more interpretation for a long time, but it doesn't start happening until the mid to late 1950s. And I think a big part of that is that they overcame the resistance to interpretation on the grounds of that it was incompatible with objectivity, because many of them had seen how McCarthy in his rise as a great anti-communist demagogue, many thought, had kind of exploited the press's reliance on objectivity, because many of the reporters who covered him, they thought that he was really spouting nonsense with many of his accusations and that he had very little proof to back it up. But objectivity as practiced in that era didn't allow them to say that in news articles. And so they felt kind of complicit, the industry really felt kind of complicit in enabling McCarthy's rise and determined to have a kind of reporting that would not allow the press to be manipulated in that way in the future. And that for many of them, that was interpretive reporting that was going to give some context and an analysis to what people in the news were saying and doing.
So in a way, sort of McCarthy sort of used the press's norms against, for his own gain, kind of against the press in a way.
Sure, yeah, and I think that is kind of a standard historical interpretation of McCarthy's rise, that he was able to get headlines with sensational accusations because he was a prominent person. He's a U.S. senator, so what he says is automatically going to be news, and the more prominent the people or the institution that he attacks, the larger the headlines will be. So yeah, certainly.
So in a way, I mean, while these sort of things are important, the commercial interest is really the main thing. And to a certain extent, it almost feels to me like at times that these other things are, I don't quite want to say after the fact justifications, but maybe to a certain extent. And it seems to me that if we go back even further, that the whole kind of, we don't have to kind of get off into this, but the whole, rise of objectivity in the first place was in part driven by commercial necessity just earlier on in history.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, right. And certainly the first news outlet to practice objectivity in the United States was the Associated Press. And they did that out of commercial necessity because they wanted their stories to be purchased by newspapers that had all different ideological slants. And so they didn't want to turn off one side or the other side. And it was kind of a similar rationale for the newspaper industry taking up objectivity in the 1920s. It was a time when, after lots and lots of growth in the total number of newspapers, there began to be consolidation. So there were fewer competing newspapers in each city, and they could theoretically get readers from a broader swath of the public. And so, again, the idea that, well, we don't want to turn anyone off with what they see as biased coverage.
Right. Yeah. And so this time when we start to see this change to more interpretation, we're talking the mid-60s, it's also a time that some prominent conservatives start to complain about unfair press coverage. I mean, first we have Barry Goldwater, then Spiro Agnew, who was Richard Nixon's vice president. But in the book, before that point, you argue that conservatives weren't unhappy with newspapers because the news business was, in a sense, kind of inherently conservative. I think that was a really interesting point, and I was hoping you could explain that a little bit.
Yeah, I'd love to. So, yes, I do think that really prior to the 1960s, the newspaper business was inherently conservative in a way, and that's leaving aside the question of editorial pages and columnists, which also were overwhelmingly right-leaning because they reflected the interests of the publishers, who were mostly Republicans. But even the news coverage, I think, had a sort of inherently conservative bent because there wasn't this interpretation that was usually put into the news articles. And really, the perspectives that were amplified in news stories were the perspectives of people in power, people in control. They were establishment conservative perspectives. The people quoted were going to be powerful politicians and executives and people at the heads of important societal institutions. So it kind of reflected the perspective of the established power structure, and wasn't really very adversarial either, something I also get into in the book. So it didn't do much to question the motivations or the sincerity of some of the people in positions of power. So really, it kind of reflected the world as the people in power wanted to see it.
Right, and actually, Spiro Agnew particularly really kind of went at this in a way that maybe we hadn't seen by any major political figure really in history, and maybe not up until, say, more modern times, Donald Trump. And it seems to me that there were, you mentioned kind of four main components or aspects to his critique of the media, right? That they're interpreting way too much and not kind of just reporting the facts, that they focus too much on bad news, they're kind of a conflict bias, if you will, and that we have these new liberal, usually young liberal columnists who just attack. And then we start to see, because these liberal biased reporters, they leave their opinions, that they put them into the news articles and don't leave them on the editorial page. And I'm wondering, do you think there was anything to Agnew's critique? I mean, was he right to be upset, or was it just kind of like sour grapes?
I mean, certainly he raised some valid points. There's no doubt about that, I think. But I think on some points he was on firmer ground than others. I mean, the notion that there's too much negative news, this is something that news executives themselves were concerned about, as I as I mentioned in the book. And I think that's kind of the nature of news, you know. I think one of the quotes I have from the Los Angeles Times publisher from one of his speeches addressing this issue is that, you know, if 1,000 children go to school and one child is hurt on the way to school, well, of course, that's the news. And that's not a good news story, but that's what's noteworthy and what people, whatever they say, that's what people are actually interested in hearing about. And certainly the angle that there's too much interpretation, I think that was kind of coupled with the idea that there's a liberal bias, right? And that the interpretation was really just kind of smuggling in the reporter's personal beliefs. That happened and continues to happen occasionally. I think it's not to the degree or as frequently as Agnew and others who followed in the same vein would claim, and that most of the time journalists are trying to do their job and put their personal biases aside, and certainly nobody's perfect, and oftentimes opinions and biases do seep into the coverage, and probably, yes, it's more often left-leaning biases than right-leaning, but I don't think it was as dramatic slant as Agnew and many Republicans since him would claim. Certainly, the his other point about the editorial page and columnists, it's interesting that he brought that up, because really there's a big divide in his time and even ever since between some of the most prominent kind of nationally recognized newspapers and the rest of the press. So, yeah, I mean, if you look at the most prominent newspapers in the country, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, they had very left-leaning opinion pages in those years. The LA Times kind of shifted from right-wing to centrist to left-wing eventually. But Agnew didn't mention the fact that the majority of the country did not read those particular newspapers. They were reading their own local newspapers, and there, really, the balance of editorials and columnists was certainly not on the left. If anything, it was more to the right. There were more right-wing columnists were more widely syndicated than left-wing columnists.
Right.
So, you know, in your local paper in Des Moines or Boise or wherever it is, you were much more likely to get an editorial page that was, on the whole, more to the right than to the left. But if you're looking at the more prominent national publication, then it was the reverse.
Right. And that was, I mean, a very different world in which, and I think people listening today, especially younger folks, wouldn't necessarily appreciate that those national outlets have, it seems to me, so much more of a reach today because everything's online, whereas, you know, not the case then. So,
right. I shouldn't even really call them national newspapers. There was really no such thing as a national newspaper back in the 60s and 70s. They really circulated only in their local metropolitan areas.
Right. And this change, I mean, I got the sense that Richard Nixon was particularly dismayed, almost felt betrayed by the LA Times. I mean, he's a California politician, and it seemed like it was a sense of he felt the LA Times was supposed to be his personal cheerleader, and all of a sudden they shifted away from that. And he's like, well, what happened, guys?
Right. Yeah. No, Nixon has a fascinating personal history with the LA Times. It's covered really well in this classic book by the journalist David Halberstam called The Powers That Be, that is kind of inside look at four different news outlets. but yes, indeed, I mean, as I said, the LA Times was a very conservative newspaper before the 1960s and was a huge backer of Richard Nixon. In fact, one of Richard Nixon's main political kind of gurus and advisors during his rise, and as you say, as a California congressman before becoming vice president, one of his main advisors was the political editor of the Los Angeles Times, a guy named Kyle Palmer. And so Nixon had always gotten very, very favorable coverage from the LA Times during his time in Congress and as vice president under Eisenhower in the 1950s. They had been firmly behind him and really amplifying everything he did in the news columns and printing positive editorials about him. And so, yes, it was a tremendous shock when the paper did essentially not quite a 180. They still endorsed him, actually, even in 1968 and 1972, to the dismay of many staffers. The editorial page still endorsed him for president, but certainly the coverage became became a lot tougher.
Yeah. And what's interesting about this period to me is, well, you have this critique from the right, but at the same time, you have these people on the left, including a number of reporters, especially some younger ones, saying, well, objectivity is something we should get rid of. I mean, and it seems to me that there were basically three main objections to it. It's impossible. It's just basically entirely subjective, and that it has this sort of establishment bias. I mean, and so can you talk a little bit about that critique of objectivity from the left?
Yeah, I think it was a huge factor in this era, and is kind of a forgotten critique, although it has sort of reemerged a little bit in the past few years. But yeah, I think those strands that you hit upon are all main parts of it. So certainly there's the kind of obvious point that no one can ever achieve pure perfect objectivity because there are so many subjective judgments that go into how you report and present the news. You know, it's subjective what the topic you're going to look at, you know, who's going to be interviewed, what the headline's going to say, etc. So even the defenders of objectivity would acknowledge that. I don't think that was quite as strong a criticism. But the question of, is it really serving the audience? Is it doing justice to the truth? That was another main criticism. And a lot of critics of objectivity on the left, many of them influenced by ideas of the new left and kind of angered by what they saw as unquestioning coverage of the government's actions in the Vietnam War in the early years. They felt like objectivity was preventing reporters from really telling the truth to their audiences and sharing what they actually knew, because they were too wary of being accused of putting some kind of personal opinion in there.
Right.
So it led the reporters to just defer to people in power and to not, you know, similar to what happened with McCarthy, right, to not question too much what, for instance, the Pentagon was saying about the progress of the war in Vietnam, even if their own reporting led them to believe that what the Pentagon was saying was completely untrue. And so that kind of gets also to this question of a bias in favor of the establishment, because objectivity, as this critique goes, basically turned journalists into, you know, transmission belts for the people in power to broadcast their views, and it meant that reporters would only really talk to people, again, who were affiliated with some kind of powerful institution and wouldn't question them too much. And so, in a sense, these are the voices that are getting amplified, and so that, in a way, is reinforcing the status quo and the power of the establishment. So this was a pretty strong movement within many newsrooms, especially it really peaks in the late 60s and early 70s at the same time as the anti-Vietnam War movement reaches its apex at the same time as Richard Nixon is in the White House, of course. So that's all very tied together, I think.
Yeah. It seems to me that there's this sort of fundamental tension between, on one hand, the fact that the kind of stenographic facts only reporting, I think it seems reasonable to argue that it does have that establishment bias. But on the other hand, the interpretive reporting can be a pretty slippery slope. And so navigating that actually requires, it seems to me, a lot more of journalists and editors than, you know, older style kind of just the facts reporting.
Yeah, definitely. And editors and news executives were really aware of this, that they're asking a lot more of reporters. It gets back to something you were mentioning a little bit before about the increasing education levels of journalists and of their audiences as well, certainly at big metropolitan newspapers like the New York Times and the LA Times. So yeah, it's a tricky thing to do, and it's a very different kind of model of reporting from what had reigned in the, you know, early part of the 20th century, where it was, you know, you call in a report from a crime scene and you just try to get the details right and not misspell the name.
Right.
And then you have, you know, a rewrite man, as they're called, back in the office, who's going to put all this into some kind of coherent form. And a reporter barely needed to be able to write to write a coherent story in order to have a successful career. That changed completely by the 60s and 70s, and it was really this emergence of the reporter as writer. And as a couple of the editors I cite in the book, there are some of their correspondents talking about how the whole balance of power in the newsroom really shifts in this period from editors to reporters.
Now, another big change in this period is we see newspapers move from almost kind of a privately owned public utility previously to what you term the reader-oriented newspaper. And can you talk a little bit about what this change was and kind of what impelled it?
Yeah, absolutely. So you said before how you detect in the book the kind of the primacy of commercial interest running through a lot of that. And I think this is probably the prime example, the idea that rather than having its primary mission as you know, informing the public and playing this role, you know, civic role in a democracy, it becomes more important for newspapers as they weather some economic challenges in the 60s and 70s to really be serving their audience as consumers, perhaps more than as citizens. And there's a tremendous profusion of material that doesn't fall into the traditional categories of hard news. So one of the kind of saving graces for newspapers like the New York Times especially, but the LA Times too, and it gets imitated throughout the country, the saving grace for them economically is that they start to introduce in the 1970s all these new sections that not just on Sundays, where traditionally the Sunday paper would have many, many sections devoted to leisure interests, but in the 70s, newspapers start to have these sections during the week as well. And it's a way to have new opportunities for advertising. So, you know, if you want to bring in more food advertisers and, you know, kitchen accessories and things for the home, furnishings, well, why not have a special section devoted strictly to that? And so that's what you start to get in the 1970s, all these weekday sections about leisure interests and soft news, whether it's entertainment or fashion or sports. And this becomes really an effort to reach readers in their capacity as consumers and in their personal lives, and not in their public lives as citizens, really.
And I think what a lot of people might not recognize or realize is that in at least in parts of this period, the New York Times really was the failing New York Times. I mean, they were really struggling, weren't they?
Yeah, definitely. In the early to mid 70s, it was a time of major crisis at the paper. You know, they were cutting back on what's called the news hole, which just means the amount of page space allotted to news. They had to cut back on that because of declines in advertising revenue and circulation. They never quite went into the red, but the profits were razor thin. And you know, there were rumors that the Sulzberger family, which had owned it since 1896 and still owns it, rumors that they were going to have to sell the paper. So yeah, they were really in trouble, and certainly it wasn't the only factor in turning it around, but arguably the biggest factor was the successful introduction of these new rotating soft news sections during the weekdays.
And this is the kind of thing, at least it seems to me, that term that sometimes people use for this service journalism is seen as this sort of lesser thing than real news, essentially, right?
Yeah. And I mean, there is a big push against it from a lot of traditionalists, especially at papers like the New York Times, which has this kind of institutional baggage of, you know, we're the paper of record and all the news that's fit to print. So there was a big pushback against this. But I mean, personally, I think that a lot of it is kind of based in snootiness and elitism. I mean, one great point that a prominent syndicated columnist for the Washington Post, Nicholas von Hoffman, makes that I quote in the book is that he observed in the late 60s that traditionally newspapers did the worst job covering the things that people care about the most: food, clothing, and shelter, basically, right? And so, you know, is it really fair to call that soft news? So no, I mean. Is it a lesser form of journalism? You know, it depends what you're comparing. You know, I don't think many people are going to argue that, you know, restaurant reviews are as important as investigative reporting about what's going on in Washington, but they're both important in their own way, certainly. And maybe, you know, stories about changes in people's lifestyles arguably are far more important than a routine bill about some piece of legislation making its way through the state capitol or through Congress.
Right. That, they're certainly more useful to a lot of people.
Mm, right. Yeah.
And this also, you mentioned, I think earlier on, this idea kind of citizens to consumers. And this comes up a number of times in the book, this move from kind of seeing people less as citizens and more kind of as consumers first, basically. And that seems to me to have some very important implications for the sort of news that we end up getting and expecting even.
Yeah, I mean, I think so, yes. And I think it also dovetails with broader trends in society. You know, and this is something that you know, that observers at the time and the historians since have chronicled, you know, this kind of retreat of the public sphere, you know, people retreating into private life more throughout the 70s and 80s. I mean, the journalist Tom Wolfe famously coined the term the me decade for the 1970s. So yes, and certainly the coverage reflects that. And, you know, there's for a long time and certainly remains this tension between the idea for news outlets of, do we tell people what they need to know or do we give them what they want, basically?
Right.
When, as in the 1970s, the future business prospects were looking kind of dim, it kind of feels like a luxury to say, oh, we're just going to tell them what they need to know and who cares what they want.
Yeah.
Right. You kind of have to cater to your audience if you want to stay in business.
And then you have some people say, well, you're just essentially pandering to the lowest common denominator when you do that, though.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you do. And I mean, certainly, you know, you hear those complaints about much of the news that we consume today.
Oh, yeah.
People will certainly say that about BuzzFeed. People will complain that the Washington Post has too many stories based on, you know, whatever viral thing is trending.
Yeah. You know, also something we should mention and that you spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about is, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, we saw a lot of changes related to women and minorities. And that also took place in the news and in newsrooms. And basically, it seems to me there are two very related issues. And the first is the lack of diversity in newsrooms, particularly in upper management, which I was surprised went on for a lot longer than I would have guessed. And also connected to that, the way in which news about women and minorities was reported, right?
Yeah, right. So this is another area of just great turmoil and change in the 60s and 70s. And to me, a worthwhile way to look at it is to split it into these two separate but related questions. The one of employment opportunity, you know, equal employment opportunity, so active discrimination against women and minorities in hiring and assignments and promotion in the news, and then also the question of news coverage and really sexism and racism in news coverage. And so certainly in the early 1960s, you know, the news industry was failing horribly on both counts, and certainly weren't the only industry. You know, this was big business throughout the country, you know, and society really reflected these discriminatory attitudes and assumptions. I mean, the numbers are remarkable. You know, the Los Angeles Times never had a woman reporter in the city room until 1964. And this wasn't because they didn't want to.
Yeah.
You know, it was because they were actively excluded. There were hardly any reporters of color on either newspaper. And for years, very few managed to get promoted to management positions. I mean, still the lack of diversity, especially in upper management jobs in the news business, is pretty shocking and pretty bad. It varies a little bit from one news outlet to the next. But I still think there's a major change that takes place in this two-decade period the change doesn't go as far as perhaps it should in terms of the numbers, the staffing numbers, but it's a pretty profound kind of change in attitude. And there are a lot of reasons for it, but I think, you know, one that I talked about a little bit is the sort of consciousness raising that takes place as a result of the feminist movement, which initially most of the men running these news outlets were totally dismissive of, but it kind of gets their attention also that they get sued by the women, certainly at the New York Times, a Women's Caucus files a lawsuit. At the LA Times, there's the Women's Caucus files a complaint with the Federal Employment Fair Employment Practices Commission, although it doesn't go to trial. So that certainly gets their attention as well. You do see by the end kind of change in the coverage. It becomes certainly not perfect, but but it becomes more kind of sensitive and nuanced in its treatment of these topics, and at least an acceptance of the reality that this discrimination is real and a problem, and something should be done to address it.
Yeah. Well, it seemed to me that the editors and the publishers, when it came to issues concerning minorities, they were concerned, sometimes very concerned. But what stunned me, maybe it shouldn't have, but it did, was just the incredible dismissive attitude and just such casual, horrific sexism that really persisted throughout this era.
Yeah. I mean, certainly there was, and the coverage of the feminist movement in the early years was horrible, really, at most major news outlets. You know, the kind of sexist assumptions that suffused it, and the fact that it barely even got any coverage in the early years. Although I try to make the point in the book that it changes a little bit over time, and there's kind of an interesting reversal in the way that newspapers handle the questions of racism and sexism. So early on in the 60s, they're far more concerned with achieving some racial diversity in the newsroom, although it often comes down to just a few token hirings. But they take very seriously the racial grievances of minorities, and they treat this as a time when race is huge news in America. You know, there's a series of urban riots throughout the 1960s, and the rise of the Black Power movement gets a tremendous amount of ink spilled about that. Whereas the rise of the feminist movement gets totally dismissed as not a serious concern. But by the late 70s, I try to argue in the book, there has been this kind of reversal where the question of race has kind of faded from the front pages a little bit. It's the headlines are no longer about as much about those kinds of questions, and feminism has won some victories both legislatively and kind of in the court of public opinion. And so more of the goals of feminists, how they wanted to change news coverage in the 60s, had been met. And partly, I think it comes back to these commercial interests again. So newspapers really wanted to make an effort to reach affluent, educated female readers, and so they tried to do that with changes in their coverage, whereas they didn't have as much of an economic desire to try to expand their readership among minority communities, regrettable though that was. And some of the Otis Chandler, for one, the publisher of the LA Times, was probably far more forthright about this than he should have been, and got into a lot of trouble for it in an interview where he said basically, no, we're not even, it's not worth it to us to try to cover minority communities because those people aren't wealthy enough to be attractive to our advertisers.
Right, yeah. Now, you mentioned the increasingly adversarial nature of the press in this period. And it kind of makes sense, I think, after Vietnam and Watergate, when it sure seems like the press was maybe a little too close to people in power. But some have argued that there was sort of an overreaction and that things have swung too far the other way and the press has become, you know, too adversarial and too combative. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that argument.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question. And I think it's always going to be kind of a matter of opinion of whether the press has become too adversarial. And it's also kind of a matter of personal preferences. Obviously, the people who are on the receiving end of the tough coverage are probably going to feel that way, whereas others, who dislike the entities being reported on with an adversarial edge, they'll feel like it should go farther. It's always a matter of the news outlets are kind of trying to strike that balance. And you know, as with objectivity, they're almost never going to be able to please everybody.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you don't focus entirely on this period of the 60s through the 80s. Throughout the book, toward the end, you talk about the period from 1980 to the present, and I love the phrase you use to describe it, validation, devastation, and alteration. Now, there's a lot. I mean, it's a long period, but can you kind of explain those three main themes that you see running through this period?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to use those three phrases to kind of periodize it in a way. So,
right.
As I say in the book, I think the two decades following the 1970s, the 80s, 90s, and a little bit of the early 2000s are kind of a validation of the values that emerged from the 1960s and 70s, because the 80s and 90s especially are the most flush years for the news industry in its history. They're just minting money. The profit margins are reliable and they're enormous, and so it gives the sense that okay, well, whatever we did in those previous decades to turn around our economic prospect, that must be working. And you know, of course, it wasn't all due to their own wisdom and wonderful values. It was also due to the fact that most newspapers had basically a monopoly position in their local markets by this time. But nevertheless, the success, I think, of those years, the financial success of the news business, was a validation of those values. And then the devastation, of course, comes in with the huge crisis that hits the news industry in the digital age, you know, starting in the 2000s with the growth of the internet, and really deepens after the 2008 financial crisis. Causes a crash in the advertising market overall. And so this is just a period, I argue, a period of 10 years or so from the mid-2000s to the mid-2010s, where news executives and journalists are just kind of absorbing the shock and trying to figure out what to do, where do we go from here? And then alteration, I think, is really just in the past few years where I think we're starting to see another change in news values on probably the same scale as the one that I describe in the book. And I think that certainly the biggest change since that period of about 50 years ago, where again, you know, the value of objectivity is being questioned in new ways, the values of, well, what's our purpose as a news organization, what are we trying to do? What are our goals? I think it's changing a lot again.
Yeah. You know, one of the biggest things that I've noticed, at least in the last couple of years, in terms of an alteration, a response to this new environment at a lot of big outlets is the metered paywall. I used to be able to go pretty much anywhere, and now I have to basically buy all these subscriptions to various things. And it seems to me that's becoming more and more common in almost all prominent publications.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think in that devastation period, people weren't sure they were trying, sort of grasping for, different business models that might be workable. And for a long time, a lot of people thought that one possible answer would be to get just a tremendous amount of users on a website or news app, and just monetize that with advertising. You know, traditionally, the business model for newspapers for years, for more than a century, was that most of the cost was covered by advertisers. It was maybe only 20% of the costs were paid by subscribers and people buying the paper on a newsstand. And so the idea was that we'll hopefully continue that. And the ad rates for online ads are really low now, but we're hoping that they're going to rise and make it sustainable. Well, by 2015 or 2016, it's apparent to most people that online ad rates are never going to get that high, especially when Facebook and Google can offer such better targeting for advertisers.
Right.
And they're just, you know, snatching up almost all of the market share and all the growth in digital advertising. So they needed to try to move to a different model. And so certainly news outlets that have a national and international reach have had some success moving to this metered paywall model, because they realize that hey, you know, the revenue has to come from the audience now. We're not going to get 3/4 of the revenue from advertisers anymore. It's just not possible.
I mean, it's kind of a concern to me, because while I'm in a position where I can afford, you know, multiple subscriptions and so forth, a lot of people aren't, basically. And so I think there's maybe right to be some concern about kind of a digital divide, when you'll have this kind of news, this kind of common news that's available to everyone for free, that's not a very high quality. But if you want the good stuff, you're going to have the means to pay for it.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is a concern. That's a concern for a lot of observers and analysts. I mean, certainly the metered paywall lets you at least view a few articles. But yeah, if you want to have a regular news source, there are still some. You know, the Associated Press, not enough people probably use their news app, which is free and very high quality. The Guardian, that British-based newspaper, but most of their audience is in the U.S., has made it kind of part of their mission. They ask people for donations on each article, because as they explain, for that precise reason, we don't want to put up a paywall, because we want everyone to have access to high quality news. And so they ask readers who can donate, rather than making them buy a subscription after accessing a certain number of articles.
Yeah, and I have to mention two great sources, and I have donated to The Guardian, because they do some really good stuff. So folks, if you haven't checked them out, definitely do. You know, we've talked now for almost an hour, and it's hard to believe that you and I could have talked about the media for almost an hour and not mentioned Donald Trump, but I don't think we have, and I can't let you go without asking about him, because, of course, earlier in the book, when you talked about how Senator McCarthy basically used the media's, or at least took advantage of the media's norms, and sort of made a name, and kind of, obviously Donald Trump comes to mind. And so I'm wondering, do you see Donald Trump as kind of a Joe McCarthy to the nth degree?
I mean, certainly there are some parallels, especially as you say, many people have argued that the media coverage kind of fueled his rise. Of course, it's what made him a household name in the first place. And then the fact that, due to his kind of sensationalistic accusations and outsized personality, he got much more coverage than his rivals in the Republican primary. So yeah, I definitely think there's that parallel. But I think maybe more the stronger parallel perhaps is between Trump and Spiro Agnew, at least when it comes to the media, because really Trump's making many of those same charges that Agnew made, and that, of course, after Agnew makes them, they become kind of a standard talking point on the right for decades. But I think Trump has ratcheted it up even farther than Agnew did, especially with this baseless accusation that news outlets are producing so-called fake news, you know, that they're actually fabricating stories based on sources that do not exist. Agnew certainly and his successors never said that, probably because it's so completely baseless. And also this attacking the role of the press in a democracy, basically saying that the press is the enemy of the people is quite a lot farther than Agnew or any subsequent Republican political figures in his mold ever went, and it is, I think, a pretty bad place to be going.
Yeah, you know, I get the sense though that the media has responded pretty, maybe more quickly now than they had in the past, in that it seemed to me there was a debate, especially I noticed the New York Times, about whether we should use the word lie when talking about President Trump's misstatements and that kind of thing. And then, of course, the Washington Post famously now put that motto up, democracy dies in darkness, which sure seems like a shot at, you know, President Trump. So what do you think about, how would you rate the media's response to the rise of Donald Trump, who for better or worse, whatever people think about his policy stances, is a very different sort of president, obviously, in regards to the
media. I think it can sometimes be hard to try to assess, you know, quote unquote, the media as a whole,
sure,
just because that's a broad brush. But I mean, if we're talking about, as most people seem to when they apply that term, talking about the kind of major national newspapers and the broadcast networks, although strangely they often seem to leave Fox News out of it, despite the fact that they're the most watched cable news network. I think those kinds of outlets they've done pretty well. I mean, certainly many reporters have had difficulty resisting kind of being snarky about Donald Trump or other political issues on Twitter and social media. I think it would probably be better if they did resist that more.
Right.
But I think clearly there have been occasions where, and I mentioned this in the book, on policy issues, there's more of kind of a, they're more likely to sort of look at whatever the Trump administration is doing through an automatically negative frame. But I mean, I think on the whole, they've done some tremendous reporting under very difficult circumstances, and have kind of balanced this need to show how, as you say, Trump is a very atypical president. Many of the things he's doing are not normal and are kind of unprecedented in the political system. And I think that there was this debate, especially earlier on in the Trump presidency, of whether the news media would kind of normalize these really divergences from years of democratic norms. And I think for the most part, these kinds of, prestigious national media have avoided doing that, which I think is probably praiseworthy.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it occurs to me too, of course, and sure, it's not coincidental that it just so happens there's a pretty strong commercial motive for going in that direction as well. I mean, even though Donald Trump talks about the failing New York Times, they've actually, I think, picked up a lot of subscribers, and this kind of oppositional media has been good for business too. And it seems like to me that's the one constant that we can see throughout really this past century or so, and probably longer, that all of these decisions are made in no small part, and usually more than anything else, due to these kind of commercial imperatives.
Right. Yeah, I think so. And certainly there was a lot of talk about the so-called Trump bump increase in subscriptions to a lot of news outlets following his election. Although I think really some news outlets have had to work harder to resist. I mean, to resist going even farther and becoming more kind of openly partisan, because as you mentioned with the paywalls, you know, the goal is to sign up paying subscribers. And I talk about this in the book as well. There's an obvious temptation to, you know, we've talked about cater or pander or whatever, an obvious temptation to serve that audience material that will, you know, that will resonate with them, that they will like, that will jibe with their pre-existing political beliefs. And, you know, journalistically, you'd like to also be able to challenge those beliefs sometimes, right? And not just have views from one side. So I think there's there's probably even more of a commercial imperative to be partisan, and they have to try to pull back on that somewhat for the sake of their, you know, for the sake of their journalistic goals.
Yeah, yeah. So one final question, we're running short, but if you kind of compared the media of, and again, obviously a broad term, but the media of 2019 with the media of, oh, I guess, maybe 1959 before all this happened, would you say that the overall media environment when it comes to political news is better, worse, what, than we had back then?
I think it's a lot better. I mean, certainly, if you get beyond political news, and you know, if you're talking about all news, just if you compare, if you look at newspapers from back then, the writing today is so much better. The range of topics is so much more interesting. The range of views is so much more diverse. The press has become so much more effective at exposing wrongdoing and keeping the powerful accountable and just raising important questions about what's going on in the country and the world and in society. So I think it's been a huge improvement. Obviously, there are still many, many problems with news coverage, but I think looking back at the past through kind of rose-colored glasses is to misrepresent the reality of it. And, you know, those people who have access to these great databases of digitized historical newspapers, I spend a lot of time looking at them in my own research. You realize pretty quickly that that things are better today than they were back then.
Well, you know, it's oftentimes rare that I get to close on an optimistic note, but I think we've done it here. So on that note, we will close. Matthew Pressman, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
It was a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. We hope you liked what you heard. Listener support is what keeps the show going, and we truly appreciate it. When you become a monthly sustaining supporter of the show on Patreon, you get not only our gratitude, but a supporters exclusive bonus episode each week, deep dive policy shows, and more. To learn more, go to patreon.com/politicsguys or visit the support page on our website, politicsguys.com/support. Subscribing to the show also really helps out, as does sharing episodes, which is easy to do right there in your podcast app. Word of mouth is absolutely the best advertising, and we greatly appreciate it. Also, leaving reviews and ratings on iTunes or whatever podcast app you're using, that helps out a lot as well. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or just something random you want to share with us, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. Our Facebook page, where you can message us and where we post throughout the week, is facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, Will Miller, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.